We're going to start things off a little bit more unconventionally today. In a moment, I'm going to say the names of a few Christian groups. If you've heard of that group before, raise your hand. All right, here we go. Ebionites. Monarchians. Miletians. Docetists. Greek Orthodox. Roman Catholics. All right. Our exercise here lends credence to the anonymous quote, "History is written by the victors." The quote is often true, but it's more complicated. Lots of times, history is written by those with the best historical records. And in the case of Christian history, both of those things are true. The Christian groups we know were both the victors, and those victors also had the best written records and went out of their way to destroy the records of those that they vanquished. I think it is useful to think of Christian history as shaped like a bit like an hourglass. So there was immense diversity initially that then got funneled down into a few common points, and then much later went back out again as Christianity got larger and larger and the diversity kept growing. And we're at a point now where we couldn't even hope to count how many different Christian groups there are. So we're going to take a trip together. This trip is free because it's a trip of historical imagination. What if the battles to control early Christianity had gone differently? If the theological and literal battles between differing schools of Christianity had gone differently, and it had led to a different set of victors and vanquished, what we know of as Christianity would be very, very different from what it is today. And those differences would impact everything, including the celebration and the meaning behind holidays. What Easter might look like had history, I want to put that as a question. What would Easter have looked like had this history transpired differently than it did? And after we go on our journey of historical imagination, I'm going to propose what the modern lesson might be for us today. All right, so let's take our first journey to the group known as the Ebionites. They were among the earliest forms of Christianity. They get their name from the Hebrew word ebionim, meaning poor. So it is possible that early on the Ebionites took vows of poverty and lived together in communes. Spiritual communes were a common thing in Roman Palestine of the time. And the reason folks had been forming communes is it made it more easy to maintain their purity and keep Jewish law. The Ebionites were interested in maintaining all Jewish laws, and they still saw themselves as Jews. Given who criticized them, we think that they lasted until the 4th century, and given where those critics lived, it seems that the Ebionites were found mostly in Palestine and in major cities of the Eastern Mediterranean, where there were significant Jewish populations. It's very unlikely that there were non-Jews, or very many non-Jews, among the Ebionites. And if you think that through, Jewish law includes circumcision. So if you're interested in spreading your message, and you go to someone saying, here's a list of all the laws you have to do, and grown men, you'll have to become circumcised, that might dampen your missionary efforts a little bit. The Ebionites were part of a branch of early Christianity we now call Jewish Christian. Calling them Jewish, calling the Ebionites Jewish, is appropriate because the group was entirely or almost entirely composed of people with a Jewish identity who in their mind were following the Jewish religion. The only Jewish law they rejected were those related to animal sacrifice. They taught that Jesus had died for the sins of the world, and therefore no additional sacrifices were needed. And in the ancient world, much meat was produced by animal sacrifices. Now, since the sacrifices were no longer needed, the Ebionites said, we are now all supposed to be vegetarian. And they argued that vegetarian was consistent with the diet of Jesus and John the Baptist. In their own gospel, called the Gospel of the Ebionites, just a few quotes have survived down to the present in the writings of their critics. But in those couple of quotes, we discovered that they changed one Hebrew letter in the word locusts. There's a biblical reference that John the Baptist ate locusts. So they changed one letter of it so that locust became pancakes instead of locusts. So in their translation, John the Baptist ate pancakes and honey, not locusts and honey. Now, that may seem a little bit fraudulent, but keep in mind, before the printing press, very common for translation mistakes to enter into text, so it wouldn't actually be that much of a stretch to say, oh, that one letter got wrong, and we're going to correct it. So calling them Jewish is appropriate, yet calling the Ebionites Christians is also appropriate, because they believe that Jesus was a specially anointed prophet. He was anointed by God at his baptism. And with the exception of Moses, who initially communicated God's laws, Jesus was the greatest prophet of all time, they taught. And that Jesus lived a model of righteousness and piety that could be a model to all the rest of us. And he's a source and model of wisdom. Right? He understood God's will and Jewish teachings better than anyone had since Moses. And yet, as special and as distinctive as Jesus was, according to the Ebionites, he was simply a human being. He was not born of a virgin. He had an ordinary birth. He did not pre-exist before creation. He was just the person who communicated God's will the best. But ultimately, only God was God. Our Unitarian ancestors had this belief in common with the Ebionites. Unitarians rejected a Trinitarian God because they said it defied reason and their understanding of biblical evidence. For the Ebionites, rejecting the divinity of Jesus, for them, that's what was consistent with Judaism. They never stopped seeing themselves as Jews, which is why they continue to follow Jewish laws. A divine Jesus is, in fact, antithetical to Jewish belief. A divine Jesus only works when you say that a new religion was born and it supersedes all of that old stuff. The Ebionites didn't see the Hebrew Bible as old stuff that had been superseded. They saw it as the stuff. From what we can tell, they added very little to Jewish scriptures. The Gospel of the Ebionites attempted to synthesize the four Gospels, and they rejected all of the biblical material from Paul. So in other words, they did not have a New Testament. They simply acknowledged a new prophet within the boundaries of Judaism. So given all of this, what might the Ebionite Easter have looked like? I decided to draw it. Now, I don't have very much artistic talent, so please, no laughing. I think this is what their Easter would have looked like. Nothing. That fit within my artistic talent. There would not have been an Ebionite Easter because Jesus is a human who had an ordinary death. Therefore, he did not resurrect after he was executed. Jesus, according to Ebionite belief, would be resurrected at some time in the future along with all the other righteous faithful. What the Ebionites might have celebrated is what Christianity would later call Good Friday, the day of the execution of Jesus. And if they did, it was probably would have been a mournful time to mark the loss of Jesus from their community. Or possibly it could have been a celebratory time to commemorate the life of Jesus, the person who lived a perfect Jewish life. Or it might have looked exactly like Jewish Passover. I'm making guesses here because we don't know a lot about the Ebionites, and we don't have any idea what their holidays look like or if they added anything to the Jewish calendar. But if they did add some holidays to the Jewish calendar, Easter would not have been among them. From the Ebionites, let's move to a group that is their theological opposite, the Docetists. And this word comes from a Greek meaning dokein or to seem, or the Greek word dokesis, meaning apparition or phantom. Their opponents call them the illusionists. Now, what phantom and illusion are referring to is the belief among the Docetists that Jesus was composed of 100% divine, supernatural, immaterial essence. He was never human in any way, shape, or form. And here's their argument. Humans, they said, are sinful, evil, filthy little critters. And if God is one of those, How can she still remain the most pure, most good, most beautiful, most mighty being in the whole universe? If God assumed a material form, it would compromise the immaterial, divine, supernatural God and pollute them with sinfulness. They said, well, God is not the slightest bit sinful or evil. Therefore, God was not and cannot ever be material, because material things are nasty. However, the Docetists said, well, there's no point in God coming down here to earth if they remain totally supernatural, immaterial, and invisible. Because that's the same as always, right? God is already everywhere as a divine immaterial essence and supernatural entity. Therefore, the Docetists say, when God chose to be visible on earth and speak directly to humanity with some new messages for us, rather than do so indirectly as before, they created the appearance of a human body. It's a phantom, an illusion. That gave us humans, simple-minded humans, something to see and focus on, and it kept us from getting all freaked out in the presence of God because it looked kind of human and relatable. So Docetist theology then would have found Easter to be virtually meaningless because God did not have a material body. Therefore, God cannot suffer. God cannot die. And if God never died, there's no need to be reborn or resurrected. Now, perhaps a Docetist would have been sad about the fact that God decided to leave Earth when they did. And they might be sad about the illusionary death and that they chose to depart in that way. But guess what? Nothing happened to God. No human can harm God. Now, like the Ebionites, we don't know a whole lot about what the Docetist calendar may have looked like. But it seems quite likely that they would have felt no need to have an Easter, as God was neither crucified nor resurrected within their beliefs. So we've just taken a brief look at two early forms of Christianity. What does this mean to us? I believe there is a lesson here for any religion in this story, including Unitarian Universalists, about tolerance and intolerance. The image I selected for this week is a Greek depiction of the Council of Nicaea from 325. So going back to our idea of an hourglass, the Ebionites and Docetists are in the early wide base with a very diverse early Christianity. This council begins the funneling process inward towards homogenization. This image here is political, and it contains many exaggerations to support the historical narrative and the beliefs of the victors, what was in the process of becoming the Greek Orthodox Church. Greek art tends to be orderly, which is why everyone is there depicted in nice rows. The council was anything but orderly. Some opponents weren't invited. Others suffered various misfortunes along the way. So in other words, the room was politically stacked from the get-go, and it favored one form of Christianity over others. Then once they were there, whoever managed to get to the room, they all shouted at one another until one side with the best and most popular shouters was declared the best form of Christianity and everybody else was a heretic. Another exaggeration in this depiction, I'm not sure how well you can see in the lower left corner, there's no historical evidence that Jesus was a signatory of the document. If Jesus was present, then in my mind it begs the question about why the proceedings were so chaotic and ultimately led to violent consequences. The goal of the council was to get Christians to come to a common understanding of what Christian theology was. But anytime you define what something is, you're simultaneously defining what it is not. The outcome of the council was to divide Christendom into a set of victors and vanquished. The Ebionites, Menarchians, Docetists, Meletians, Donatists, Monophysites, Miaphysites, and on I could go, were all labeled as wrong. Violence became a tool to convince them of their wrongness, and if they remained unconvinced, drive them away or eradicate them. The consequences for the vanquished were mixed. Some groups were violently crushed. Others gradually dwindled over time until they disappeared. Others fled and managed to survive to this day by moving into Africa and Asia and out of the reach of the Roman Empire and the Greek and Roman churches. Yet regardless of exactly what happened to the vanquished groups, they all suffered from intolerance and persecution. And this intolerant side of Christianity would continue throughout history and has justified a very staggering list of atrocities. Now, if you've been thinking, get back to the Easter part, here it is. The roots of Easter emerged within intolerance. One of the decisions the Council of Nicaea made was to set a common date for the celebration of Easter. Some groups have been practicing it on the Jewish Passover, and others on various days afterwards. The council said, everyone from now on will practice Easter on the Sunday that follows the first full moon after the spring equinox. And that's why Easter drifts all around in our solar calendar, because it's based on the Jewish lunar calendar. So within it, Easter has embedded two kinds of intolerance: the day in which you practice it and what it means about Jesus. According to the council, there's just one right way to celebrate Easter. But intolerance is not the only part of the Christian story. If we're being fair, we also must acknowledge Christian history has also regularly displayed charity and kindness and love and peace. And while Easter originated amid intolerance, the holiday later displayed considerable tolerance and accommodation. As Christianity spread beyond the Greek and Latin-speaking worlds and began encountering new cultures and peoples, Christians began finding out that their religion, heavily infused with Greek things, did not entirely replace or eradicate the non-Greek cultures and religions that they encountered. So our hourglass that narrowed in at the council began widening back out as people took on the new religion, but they simultaneously kept practicing parts of their cultures and religions that they liked and didn't want to abandon. And that included celebrations of spring. The word Easter comes from the Germanic goddess Ostra or Ostara. Matt, if you could go to the next one. Okay. This is a 1901 drawing of this goddess. Our knowledge of Ostara is not very plentiful. We don't know exactly what the festivals dedicated to her looked like, but we do know that she was associated with spring and with renewal and with fertility, and because of that was associated with things of fertility like eggs and bunnies. And I trust that that sounds familiar. There came a point where Christian leaders gave up trying to eradicate such practices. And the reason they gave up is because they were utterly failing at it. But nonetheless, they gave up and eventually accommodated these kinds of practices. So for centuries, Christian Easter and pagan Ostara have lived side by side in peace, practiced simultaneously throughout Europe and the places that have been settled by Europeans, as is true in our country. Matt, if you could go to the third slide. There we go. So I would like to offer today a universal Easter message. The history of Easter began surrounded by intolerance and violence and the loss of some of Christianity's diversity. The disappearance of the Ebionites, the Docetists, and all the others, well, it made Christianity less rich. Perhaps those groups may have had something to offer that religion and maybe the rest of the world. But in time, Easter moved away from its intolerant roots and came to a place of tolerance and religious coexistence with two religions living in the same holiday. Well, what better kind of message could there be for spring? Religious tolerance, religious coexistence, that's an Easter message about peace and renewal and faith in change and the ability to create a better future. These are all themes that we need in our lives, regardless of our own theological or spiritual stance. They are also themes that this community and all UU congregations can benefit from. As a quote from Al Borland puts it on your order of service, no winter lasts forever. No spring skips its turn. Renewal and change are always possible. It is my Easter wish for you and for all of us that all concepts of Easter, including no Easter, and the people and groups who hold them, whether religious or secular, theist, polytheist, or non-theist, live together in peace and mutual toleration. There has been more than one Easter for a very long time. There's enough room for us all there. Happy Easter and happy Ostara.